What do you think are the reasons why we're not seeing the big money laundering prosecutions in traditional finance? Why SBF and crypto cases, convictions, people being locked up? It seems that justice moves a lot quicker on the crypto cases, yet I'm sure you can rhyme off more than me. I can think of five multi-billion dollar cases involving traditional finances and banks, and no one has ever prosecuted.
There's a long entrenched history of how money laundering, fines and compliance failures and prosecutions and regulations kick in. It's often very boring. Linking it to something tangible like Institution X was fined because it was laundering money for this drug gang, that's interesting. Institution X was fined because of compliance failures is death by headline. It's awful. And so perhaps that's one reason why those more traditional institutions, they do get fined. There are failures, but they just don't hit the headlines because they're reported in a boring way because the regulations and the regimes around it are long and entrenched and boring. Crypto is new, it's exciting, it's different. You've also got in crypto, more than you have in traditional finance, characters. CZ in charge of Binance, Sam Bankman-Fried in charge of FTX.
Public facing noisy characters, unlike the invisible grey sort of pinstriped stereotypical bankers.
Exactly.
I'm Danny Haston, Chief Revenue Officer at Asset Reality. Welcome to Cease and Desist. In this episode, recorded on 20th of June, Aidan is joined by Jeff White, acclaimed author of The Lazarus Heist, which looks at the impact of North Korean cyber warfare on the global stage, and his latest book, Rinsed, which reveals how the global underworld washes its dirty money in the internet age. Jeff is also a speaker, podcast creator, and investigative journalist known for his work on the intersection of organised crime and technology. He has been featured by a host of media outlets, including BBC News, Channel 4, Sky News, and The Sunday Times, amongst many others. In this episode, Aidan and Jeff explore the systems criminals exploit to hide their activities. They discuss the pivotal role of investigative journalism in uncovering financial crimes, as well as on-chain and off-chain criminal activity, and the evolving landscape of technology-enabled money laundering. Stay with us as we dive into this week's episode. Thank you for listening.
Hello and welcome to Cease and Desist. My name is Aidan Larkin, your host, and I am delighted to say that I'm joined today by Jeff White. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hi, Aidan. Thanks for having me.
We've sort of bumped into each other at a couple of events, and I think I've been sort of secretly stalking you. You just don't know it. For every sort of large crypto event I've turned up at over the last sort of 3-4 months, I've noticed that you were on the agenda from the Chainalysis Links event right through to more recently Money 2020 in Amsterdam. We always talk about the stories behind the cases. I mean, our audience is people who are dealing with the enforcement activity around seized assets and seized digital assets. And on the front end, then you're in an envious position of getting to tell the stories and tell the world about what is actually happening. Would you like to introduce yourself, Jeff, and tell us a bit about the latest book?
Sure, yeah. So I'm an author and investigative journalist, and the area that I concentrate on is organized crime and technology. So ever organized crime and tech come together, that tends to be where I hang out. So obviously a lot around computer hacking, but also, you know, cartel drug dealing and prostitution rings online, fraud and money laundering. So all these things are increasingly technologically enabled, and they're all organized crime enterprises. So that's kind of the territory that I inhabit.
And it is a fascinating piece because one of our main themes and the aims of this podcast was around, you know, trying to keep these incredibly complicated subjects understandable. We often talk about the practitioner trying to go to court to get a freezing order on crypto assets, and judges are asking, get Satoshi Nakamoto into my courtroom, please, or, you know, which jurisdiction is these blockchain cases dealt with? How do you find that? I mean, you've had a very sort of long and storied career as an investigative journalist, and most people will know you from acting as the co-creator and co-presenter of the wonderful Lazarus Heist podcast. How do you approach these incredibly complicated topics, but then break it down in a way? Because I would say you even have a harder job than law enforcement practitioners, because you're trying to reach the general public, you're trying to reach the widest possible audience. What does your approach look like when you're trying to describe the blockchain, digital assets, crypto assets?
It's really interesting. That's a really interesting question. What I've tried to do in my new book, Rinsed, which is about where technology and money laundering meet, the sort of links between technology and money laundering and that sort of symbiotic relationship. Again, approaching that, you know, money laundering is a complicated subject, technology can be a complicated subject. So my job is to stand between, you know, the folks that you've interviewed previously and that you work with and alongside, who frankly do the job. They're at the front end, and without them, there would be no story. My job is to sort of stand between that community of people and the public and to try and explain to the public how it goes. And interestingly, you mentioned the Lynx conference, which was held by Chainalysis, the crypto tracing firm, I think it's fair to say, is the description of them, in New York. And there was a really fascinating presentation between, I think it was a New York police officer and then an attorney who actually brought the case, a public attorney. And the police officer explains how they managed to track the crypto down, and they found the criminal and they put them in court. And then the lawyer came on and he said, well, okay, you've heard all of that. My job now is to put that in front of a jury who've never heard of cryptocurrency. And this was the bit that really got to me and stuck with me. They can't stop me at any point, put their hands up and say, hang on, wait, can you explain that again? They sit there mute and I have to just explain something and do it in such a way that I know they'll understand it, even though they can't stop me and ask for more explanation. And I looked and I thought, well, that's my job. That's the same as what I do as a journalist. People can ask questions, you know, after the podcast goes out, they can ask questions about the book. But as they're reading or listening or watching the output that I do, they can't stop and ask me to go back and explain it a bit more. So you've got to really drill down into it. And for me, the best, and it is old advice in a way, cliched and hackneyed advice, but the best advice is to try and explain it like you're explaining it to your mum or dad or your gran or somebody in the pub. Analogies can sometimes help. You've got to be quite careful with analogies. Sometimes they fit, sometimes they don't. But it's just trying to find those ways to talk somebody through it step by step. And examples can help as well. You know, if I send you some cryptocurrency, so immediately you phrase the story in a kind of me and you situation. In cybersecurity, I'm not sure the same in crypto, but they have this thing of Alice and Bob, which is often used to explain cryptography. Alice sends Bob an encrypted message. Like, oh no, nobody knows who Alice and Bob are. If I send you an encrypted message, I think it's a better way of doing it because it makes it personal to the recipient of the message. So those are some of the ways that I try and do it, but it's complicated stuff.
Yeah, and it is. I think at the highest level, even the fundamentals of crypto in particular as an asset recovery topic is very complicated. And when you start to talk about sending crypto, people often glaze over when there's always that person in the room and they're right when they sort of say, but actually you're not sending anything anywhere. Yeah. Crypto's not moving. We are. The keys are, in many cases, and it's understanding the distinction between when you control an asset, and I usually get drawn back to the example of the bank vault. Sometimes you can just change the key to the vault and give someone else a new set of keys. Other times you can empty the vault and move it to a different location. And we're in exactly the same position where we try and have those sort of conversations. But I think that what really drew me in, I listened to one of the recent podcasts you did, and forgive me, I think it was a Swedish or Norwegian conference. Recently, there was a podcast about the laundromat themed event and their resulting podcast. And we were talking about the fact it's not about a digital asset. It's just, it's fraud. It's financial crime. Yes. It's just that the venue has changed. The arena has changed. Now it's financial crime in a digital age. What got you inspired in focusing on this, you know, niche of tech and organized crime and the interaction of money laundering? What was your journey to be able to write these sorts of books and explore these topics?
Yeah, it's a good question. I was working at Channel 4 News, which is a big news program in the UK. It's one of the more august news programs. It's a 50-minute in-depth program. And what was good is you could do investigative journalism. You could delve into things. Started covering tech there, and then the problem with covering tech was we do all these stories about like iPads and iPods and video games. And the problem there is you're at the end of the program, which is a vulnerable place to be because you're the sort of end of program funny. And obviously that means if something comes in at the top, you get pushed off the end. That's how TV news works. Yeah. If you've got a limited run program, limited time program. We kept getting pushed off the end. And I started going to these tech conferences and cybercrime conferences and thinking, well, hang on, there's all this stuff going on. People are losing real money. Companies are being hacked. Nations are clearly waging cyber war on each other in the background. This matters. And also, this is hard news and it will get us up the news agenda. So gradually, as I did investigations, we moved up the news agenda until the point where you're the lead story. And when you're the lead story on a program, it's very hard to drop you because, you know, the press release has been written, the headlines have been cut. You are the lead story. So you're unassailable from that point of view. But from there, I started moving into sort of organized cybercrime, obviously nation state, but also criminal gangs moving online. And what was interesting about that was I didn't think I was covering money laundering, but in hindsight, a lot of the investigations, this is obviously based on cyber crimes, which often generate money, particularly the non-state, the organized criminal gang hacking type stuff, and they needed to vanish the money and escape the money. So suddenly I found myself reversing into this money laundering picture. And that was what in the end made me think, all right, I'm going to actually try and write a book about this, explain what money laundering is, how it works, and perhaps most importantly, how tech is starting to rocket fuel this industry, as I've described it in the book.
And that's a great summary. And I've just checked my notes. It was the Laundry podcast.
Oh, yes.
That I listened to recently. And yeah, it's something that I think that yourselves and a lot of the investigative journalists sort of deserve credit for. I'm a big fan of Oliver Bullough. I've met him a couple of times at sort of economic crime conferences. Mm. And it's almost without the work that you guys do, there isn't really that awareness. As you say, it becomes this often, if it's not on the right news channel, just too complicated to understand.
Yeah.
And I think you guys did a really good job bringing it to that. The podcast series and then the book from Lazarus, you know, something that could potentially either, it can swing from being either something out of a Bond movie to actually it's just a really advantageous, they spotted a way of basically being able to steal something.
Mm.
And again, it's just this, the venue is effectively changing. But what do you think is the primary role of sort of investigative journalism in these states? You know, it's not about the headline, but what do you find is the feedback, or as you're seeing these, are you guys, I would love to learn the genesis of this. Is it seeing the story breaking? Are you out in the field?
Mm.
I mean, how does this all come together, which results in this enormous body of work?
It's a really interesting question. I'm aware, as I'm saying this, that there are many, many other investigative journalists who do work that is frankly much better and more in-depth and more dangerous and edgy than mine. And you mentioned Oliver Bullough there again, whose work's fantastic. There are lots of other journalists working in this space who are closer, really frankly, to the sharp end than me. So I'll say that first of all.
I was going to say, given the topic of your book and the people in your book, I would say you're sitting pretty close to the wind at the moment with the enemies that you could potentially be making. But we're all in the same boat. We have to,
yeah.
I think you're on the right side of history, is how I would put it.
Hopefully so, yeah. But look, I mean, the other thing is I come from, you know, approaching my late 40s, now early 50s. Like, the era I came from, investigative journalism was this sort of art form where, you know, people didn't tend to train in my era as investigative journalists and get made investigative journalists. You sort of emerged, it was in your DNA and you couldn't fight against it. And one stage, you're obsessive like me, you'd just become an investigative journalist. I can never leave a story behind. I mourn every single story that I've never got to the bottom of. Like, why did we not find the answers to that? And so if you ask, slightly obsessive like that. Also, there's a sense of imposter syndrome about it. People expect me as a journalist to know everything about a story. And I always felt incredibly self-conscious if I didn't. And they'd ask me a question, I go, oh, I don't really know the answer to that. And that felt wrong. Like, they were looking at me like, well, you're the journalist. Didn't you understand all of this? So I think if you're the kind of person who wants to really understand a story, possibly because you want to close down that imposter syndrome and feel like you really do understand something to the point where you can answer almost any question on it, investigative journalism is your thing. The way I go about it is I'm looking for an issue that's of relevance broadly in society. I'm looking for that issue where if you chat to somebody in the pub or in a cafe and you say, hey, you know, this thing, the dark web or money laundering or cybercrime or fraud, they sort of go, well, yeah, I've heard of that, but don't really understand it. And yeah, it's big, isn't it? But like,
how did it affect me, type of thing?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. The issue that people haven't really, they know it's there, they know it's important, but it's a bit like, to research it, you'd have to go away and read lots of dry books. It's a bit like trying to give somebody their vegetables or their brown bread. You know, what I try and do is say, okay, I'm going to take that brown bread and those vegetables, but cover it in really tasty toppings, and you'll like eating it. And at the end of the day, you've got your intake of vitamin B and C and whatever, but you've also enjoyed the ride. And key to that is finding the story, the narrative in it. And in a way, that's not as difficult as you might think. Pick a story, start at the beginning and explain it. A, B, C, D, E, just keep going through the steps. The one thing I do as an investigative journalist that's absolutely critical is put things on a timeline. You would not believe how useful that is, because immediately you can see, oh, this bit is missing. How did they get from that bit to that bit? Hang on, there's a bit here where, you know, it goes, the story goes off. What happens there? As soon as you can put things on a timeline, A, you can spot the gaps and where you're going to investigate. But B, humans, we're chronological beings. We exist in time. You know, the very basics of things, it's time. And so if you're telling a story chronologically, naturally the listener, the viewer, the reader is going to want to follow it along because they want to know what happens next. We all want to know what happens next. And that's a chronology. So those are the things that I look for in terms of an investigation. Is there an issue, and are there stories that are exciting and interesting that I think will work as a what happened next?
Well, I think obviously you're being very humble, because when you just have a read down through some of the topics you've covered, I think this book was always a long time coming, because everything from crime.com Vietnam through to the Lazarus heist. And now you're approaching this sort of the topic that is very dear to my heart, is the fact that asset recovery globally, how we take things from criminals, underperforms. The common statistic that is quoted and has been for nearly a decade is that it's circa 1% of illicit proceeds are finally covered and forfeited. And clearly there's a lot to be done. And there is that massive misunderstanding that virtually every talk I give, I ask people, no, have a wild guess. What is the current estimate for amounts of money laundered globally? And it's rare that unless someone's actually read the report or listened to us in the past, they know that number. And I mean, I think the current estimate is circa sort of 3 to 4 trillion per year. I mean, these are just eye-wateringly astonishing roles. And I think, Rinses, you're unpacking the role of tech, and you have this almost perfect playground for those involved in money laundering to use these new systems and this new venue. But it's also very easy for people to maybe think, oh, this is a terrible technology, then surely we should shut it down. I would love to give you the floor here to set the stage a little bit and unpack some of those issues within the book and the role the technology plays, and why this technology, why are we seeing it now? And maybe what should we be thinking about as listeners?
Yeah, it's interesting. And I'm aware in the book, obviously focusing on technology and money laundering, cryptocurrency forms a large part of that. And I'm aware cryptocurrency as a share of the global financial system is very small. And I think it's fair to say the amount of criminal money in cryptocurrency is the minority and not the majority of money. Now, some people, I think, disagree with that. And I've spoken to people who just say, oh, it's all criminal, isn't it? I just don't think that's fair. I think unless you're going to back that up with some proper research and statistics, trotting that out there is a bit pat. But there is illicit use in cryptocurrency, definitely. My other concern is around the statistics of illicit use of crypto, this sort of, oh, it's 1% or less than 1% or only a few percent. Well, one of the stories I cover in the book is about a pair of heroin dealers, a middle-aged pair called the Din Sisters in Manchester, who on the surface ran a beauty parlour and then in the background was smuggling in heroin from Pakistan and selling it on the streets of Manchester. Now, they sold heroin for cash. That cash gets converted into crypto. Now, at that point, the cryptocurrency tracing firms would not know, as far as I can work out from their methodology, that that crypto is illicit crypto. It's from drug trade because it's a cash to crypto transfer. Most of what they're basing this on is, for example, ransomware payments. If you pay a ransomware payment, they can then see, oh, that wallet there that the payment was made into is a ransomware gang's wallet. So we can track that and see the flows in and out. A transaction like I've just talked about, a drug cash transaction, from what I know, wouldn't show up on the radar. So that estimate of it's less than 1% or only a few percent, I think it's fair to say that's an underestimate. I don't know what the actual reality is, and I don't know how we would get there, but certainly there's a chunk of illicit use of crypto. My worry is that traditional finance has thought to itself, well, crypto's over there. We don't do crypto. You know, we are National Bank X. We're not even close to custodying crypto. We're not going to touch that. So we don't have to worry about it. Well, that argument is going to get more and more difficult to run. Your customers will increasingly have crypto. They will use crypto. They'll expect to be able to convert their crypto into fiat currency via your bank, via their bank account. If they are involved in fraud, either willingly or unwillingly, or wittingly or unwittingly, the proceeds of that fraud can end up hitting your bank. You know, it started off in crypto, but it gets to your bank. So this idea that crypto is that weird territory that's over the fence and you can just close your eyes to it, I just don't think that argument plays anymore. The other thing that's interesting in terms of how traditional finance and technology have moved this money laundering scene forward is we've obviously had innovations like faster payments and online account creation. The COVID pandemic fed into this. We had massive movement towards online banking. People who'd never adopted it before suddenly adopt it. And you've got this febrile pace of technological innovation. You've got issues around identifying who people are when they set up accounts online. You've got issues of money mules being recruited online and making their accounts available. So even if you put aside that new finance crypto type territory, and even if you do think you can just hive it off and it's over the fence somewhere. In traditional finance, these technological innovations, this speed and frictionless experience they want to give customers is creating money laundering issues itself. And then you get the crossover between the two where the crime starts in crypto land, but then the money's put into the bank, washed through very quickly thanks to faster payments, moved to a different jurisdiction. So across the scene, in all types of finance, old and new, technology is sort of rocket fueling, thanks to the speed, the frictionless nature of it, is rocket fueling those money laundering tactics.
So you've hit on two or three of my favourite topics
away
in crypto and asset recovery. And I want to take you back because I unanimously was nodding along here, unanimously agreeing with exactly what you're saying. This is almost as if we planned this and we actually didn't. So this is great. This is great. You've hit these two topics. So I've made a note to myself to remind, so to come back to this as you were chatting there, and I wrote down illicit slash ignorance. And there are two topics that I'm keen to get your view on. I think I 100% agree with you. And I think it's, I'll unpack it a little bit. The illicit number in crypto is this much debated. From a listener's perspective, for those that don't know, there's no many reports. And one of the key things about the immutability of the blockchain means that, as Jeff rightly said, you can track a transaction. And if we know that that person's a hacker, or we know that that person is using a mixer, and then they interact with this other wallet, well, then we can make a good guess that this is also controlled by the same person. Therefore, it's an illicit wallet. And this very detailed piece of computer science and sort of attribution starts to take place. And it's like smart water infecting everybody that's held the stolen property.
Yeah.
So I completely agree. We can look at illicit activity and we can say absolutely, with almost absolute certainty, it's at least this amount, whatever that number is. But you've highlighted a really good example, similar to the examples we give generically when we talk about that's on-chain. Mm. We can't get the off-chain part. We can't see when someone goes into, and this is a true story, when someone goes into a trampoline park that doesn't have CCTV but has a Bitcoin ATM and a surveillance team watch people day after day after day, money mules turning up with bags and just feeding this thing banknotes, and it spits out a brand new, fresh, as you like, address that controls millions of dollars of crypto assets, and then you go to an exchange, it passes all the KYC, and you're in the system. So I completely agree with you, but I'm interested to know, if you do know the background, I mean, what was that methodology of how those sisters in that particular case, what was their cash to crypto on-ramp or methodology?
Yeah, it was, I know a certain amount about it. And this case came out of Greater Manchester Police. Mm-hmm. And also, we've already mentioned Chainalysis. This was a Chainalysis case that they investigated. Other crypto tracing firms were available, by the way. So they were dealing cash. And what they had was a whole network of couriers who were, in some cases, minor drug dealers themselves, in some cases, drug addicts, in some cases, just people who needed some ready cash and didn't want to ask any awkward questions, who were ferrying the cash around in cars. And obviously the police kept intercepting them. So eventually the gang got in touch with a guy who called himself Chem Dog, who we think lived in the southeast. And he basically said, look, you give me the cash, I will convert it into cryptocurrency. I will take a cut. I will then give you control over the wallet and I will transfer it to wherever you want it to be transferred to. Now, if you look at that in terms of logistics, getting that cash to Chem Dog and swapping it over compared to, for example, taking it to an international money transfer service, which are obviously going to be in principle governed by know your customer and anti-money laundering regulations. So you've got to find a money broker who's going to turn a blind eye to be giving tens of thousands of quid's worth of drugs cash. And then that cash gets sent or remitted to, we think, Pakistan, where they were buying the drugs. You've got to then release that cash in Pakistan. Now, obviously, you're going to be releasing it to people who are going to be going to use it to buy drugs that then get shipped into the UK. Are those people trustworthy? You know, do you trust your brokers in Pakistan? Versus the other option, which is giving it to Chem Dog. He, we think it's a he, takes it, converts into crypto, and then it's liquid, it's fluid. You can transfer it wherever you like. You can transfer it direct to your drug contacts in Pakistan. So that was the methodology. But the real kicker with this was Chainalysis did some interesting research, because, of course, as soon as they seized the phones that these couriers were using, they had messages between Chem Dog and the courier, who's a guy called Arjan Badesha, which showed the cryptocurrency wallets into which the money was going to be transferred. So Chainalysis can now go, okay, let's look at those wallets and see what happened. And sure enough, they see money going in from the drug gang, they see money going out from the drug gang, and they see that the broker's taking a percentage of 4%, because you can track, you know, how much money goes in versus how much money goes out. 4% is an absolute steal. If you translate that into profits for the drug gang, if they're washing, which we think they were probably in the millions, through these cryptocurrency brokers, that equates to profits in the thousands of pounds. There's no way, as a drug dealer, you're going to turn your back on that. It's like, wow, we use our money broker guy, he's going to charge us 30, 40, 50, whatever percent. We use this guy, it's 4%. That means we've got X thousand more profit on every deal. It's a no-brainer.
Absolutely.
So that was the sort of, that was the methodology with that. It was super fascinating.
And I think that,
just to round that off as well,
okay,
just quickly on the seizure, you'll like this, Aidan, on the seizure one, the Din sisters were not exactly brilliant money launderers. So they started spending on, you know, fast cars, Beamers, Mercs, Rolexes, loads of designer clothes, like loads of designer labels. Now the cops obviously could see all of that, track it. And when they arrested them, all that gets shipped across to Ireland and auctioned off, and they make some money back from that. As far as Manchester police told me, the crypto was never seized, never recovered. Now, what that means is if you're the Dinn sisters and you do, I think they've got about 10 years, they'll serve about five, so they get out in 5 years, potentially they can just pick those wallets up, get the keys, unlock it, and their drug money is potentially still there,
wow,
usable because it wasn't trackable, because it wasn't seizable. That's as far as I'm pretty much sure that's where the Manchester police case ended up. So again, you know, using crypto, cheaper, safer. Why wouldn't you as a crook?
And this is, well, so I have a potential as the why this could end differently. And also as an interesting aside, my own journey through asset recovery, the company that you're talking about where they ship those stuff off to Ireland was the former company that I was the asset recovery director for. So that was my department. So we had the contract with GMP, ex-GMP folks actually work on our team now. So we do know a lot of those cases, but obviously I was out in 20 or when that case actually broke. And as you were speaking, I was actually Googling that case and I didn't realize it was connected to, for me, the most fascinating criminal enterprise case of all time, which is sort of EncroChat and how this sort of encrypted messaging devices got intercepted. So I think that in itself is worth its own Netflix documentary, where you've got the combination of encrypted messaging devices being used by criminals who think no one's listening, despite the government having successfully flipped somebody. You then have them using, as you say, digital assets. And it reminds me of the similarities around the famous $3 billion seizure in the US, which was the amounts that were sitting for maybe 6 or 7 years. So this goes back to the immutability of the blockchain. So you do have a potential situation, and this isn't unique to crypto. I mean, this is something that if I was running a money laundering operation and I was convicted, had all my available assets seized, there's a good chance I've hidden a diamond somewhere. There's a good chance I've hidden a gold bar. And I've been involved in situations personally when we've been seizing assets. And now I've got a receipt for a £100,000 Rolex and we can't find the Rolex. And it's just simply it's never recovered. And of course the criminal will shrug their shoulders and say, police officer must have stolen it or someone's stolen it. But it's probably just been thrown out the window. A trusted third party's picked it up.
Yeah.
And as you say, it's just being held until they get back. But the unique difference with crypto, and we saw this in the big $3 billion seizure in the US, is that when the suspects stole the already hacked funds, they sat on it because they knew the police was watching. And the minute those funds moved, they got the IP and the OSINT attribution, they were able to go and actually arrest them.
Yeah.
So there's an element of potentially that either the assets are genuinely beyond reach and they've lost the private keys, or that actually the police know exactly where the assets are.
Yeah.
They don't have the private keys and they're just waiting to pounce. But that's one of the unique attributes around digital assets, that everything is being done on an open ledger. But as you say, the example I give, and it's similar to your own examples, is that this is an industry that's being taken advantage of. The technology is not bad.
Yeah.
It's being used and abused. And I often give the example that we don't ban air travel, even though couriers bring cash and bring drugs onto planes. But what we do is we ensure that every country has robust border controls, financial intelligence, sniffer dogs, detection methodologies. And if you had an international airport that had no customs officers, and had no x-ray machines and no sniffer dogs, guess where everyone would use, and guess the airport everyone would go to launder.
Yeah.
I think the same happens with crypto. But the other point I wanted to unpack was the ignorance, and I elicit an ignorance. And the ignorance, I say tongue in cheek, but it is around a lot of the traditional financial ecosystem. Now, we've saw spectacular headlines recently with BlackRock and the JP Morgans of the world, the Fidelities of the world, some of the biggest institutions, $1 trillion money managers getting involved in digital. But you're right, as recently as 2024, I still hear banks all around the world saying, we have no exposure to crypto. And it's like, do you have PayPal or Revolut users or any other money service sort of provisions? It's it's kind of like saying, just because you don't build a website doesn't mean you don't have exposure to the internet.
Yeah.
What do you think are the reasons why we're not seeing the big money laundering prosecutions in traditional finance? What's your view on that? Why SBF and crypto cases, convictions, people being locked up, it seems that justice moves a lot quicker on the crypto cases, yet I'm sure you can rhyme off more than me. I can think of five multi-billion dollar cases involving traditional finances and banks, and no one has ever prosecuted.
It is interesting, and there's an interesting question, and that question has occurred to me sort of tangentially, but I've never been asked it, so I'm now making up the answer as I go along, which is always great territory to be in as journalists. There's a few things I'd say. Number one is traditional financial institutions, there's a long entrenched history of how money laundering, fines and compliance failures and prosecutions and regulations kick in. and it's often very boring. Entity X gets fined X amount for compliance failures, and I almost fall asleep looking at the headline. So linking it to something tangible like Institution X was fined because it was laundering money for this drug gang, that's interesting. Institution X was fined because of compliance failures is death by headline. It's awful. And so perhaps that's one reason why those more traditional institutions, they do get fined. There are failures. We've had only in the last couple of days before recording this podcast, HSBC being found in Switzerland, being found for money laundering failures. But they just don't hit the headlines because they're reported in a boring way because the regulations and the regimes around it are long and entrenched and boring. Crypto is new. It's exciting. It's different. You've also got in crypto, more than you have in traditional finance, characters like CZ in charge of Binance, like Sam Bankman-Fried in charge of FTX.
Public-facing, noisy characters, unlike exactly. The invisible grey, sort of pinstriped, stereotypical banker.
Exactly. You've also got prosecutors, particularly in the US, who, and I hadn't really fully realised this until I was chatting to somebody recently about the way prosecution works in the US versus the UK. In the US, prosecutors want to sort of make a name for themselves. They want to launch a case which, you know, cements their career and their reputation. We have that in the UK. Lawyers obviously want to be successful and want to get big cases. But in the US, it's much more, a bit more naked and transparent and mercantile. So again, they will go after a big sexy case with a new type of technology to sort of make a big show of things. That's possibly one explanation. The other thing that people have said to me, that I don't know how you'd substantiate this, but the theory among some in the crypto community is this is traditional finance trying to get new finance, edge it out of the picture or tame it or rein it in or knock it down. And that's what's behind these crypto cases. This narrative comes out often when the crypto prosecutions for money laundering happen, like FTX. Some in the crypto community will turn around and say, well, yeah, you got FTX for laundering X amount, but look at traditional bank, you know, like HSBC, for example, you know, was doing loads more. That's partly a function of the fact they're handling proportionally much more of the financial system. But why aren't you reporting them? Why are you reporting all about FTX? You know, it's obviously because traditional finance is trying to kill off this new crypto baby, as it were. I don't know. I'm just putting out there reasons why it might be more prevalent that we have money laundering convictions around new finance and crypto.
And I don't disagree with you. I think that my own sort of view on it is around that, one, it is the appetite to report on it. Even just saying, you know, the words HSBC, I can already think of the other offences. And it's like, I do get the argument that, well, if you're that much bigger, there is going to be more problems. But then I would, for the avoidance of doubt, I'm not a crypto bro in any shape of the imagination. I'm pretty agnostic. I think that the technology can be used wonderfully, but I do look at it as a former investigator who's been involved in child exploitation material investigations and murder investigations and drug trafficking and human trafficking. Like, I've seen how any technology can be used in a terrible, terrible way. I don't want to ban the internet, but I certainly want to restrict and enforce and regulate and educate and do all of the guide rail sort of things. So I'm all for safe crypto adoption. I am the guy who does agree, and I have very strong opinions on things like mixers, and that I don't see a legitimate use case for them, bar the 0.01% cases when someone is truly running for their life, when someone is truly trying to overthrow a dictator and they want to fund it. Like, outside of that, and I haven't seen it, why don't you just launch a compliant mixer that files reports in your jurisdiction, complies with the regulator, and you can still confidentially tell the regulator about the nefarious stuff? Because the reality is, you know, 99% of the customers are probably nefarious. That's why they don't do it. But I think that the banking has had a century of compliance controls practice and, you know, had all of them investment and all of the education. So I don't let them off lightly that it's a transactional piece. But I do think that what's interesting is that we're seeing this blueprint in asset recovery. And I think there is a willingness in the industry to almost self-regulate, you know, identify. Remember, the biggest abuses of the technology are also the biggest saviors. The very technology that enables faster movements of payments with pseudo-anonymity also is the kryptonite to that, because then you do have these blockchain analytic tools that can trace everything. And it's a fascinating comparison when you see that crypto asset recovery and seizures and detections and prosecutions, and maybe this is the virtuous circle why the prosecutors are jumping on that bandwagon, because the results are astonishing. I mean, crypto seizures are outstripping regular seizures like 10 to 1. We're seeing £1 billion and $1 billion seizures in crypto that has never been achieved before in regular assets. And I'm starting to think that that's maybe part of that virtuous cycle, that you've got immutable ledgers. So like Silk Road, once you find the person, you can pin the tail on the donkey very easily. You've got rock solid evidence in most cases because it's pretty immutable. It's your IP. You're caught holding the laptop that you've got a PIN number to access. And I'm wondering if that is creating that sort of virtuous cycle where they're hunting these cases down. There's permanent footprints. There's irrefutable evidence in many cases. We saw the Bitcoin fog decision go the way of the industry as well. And now then you've got recoveries being made, assets being seized, associated headlines, because no one wants to read about a money laundering case. And as you say, top of the hour on the news story, a complicated merchant banking, impossible to get your head around, but colorful guy that's been on stage with former presidents who wears shorts, who steals lots of money. It's going to lead a news story. But what do you think is the future of this? When you've done an excellent job in your book talking about the likes of the big hacks, the Lazarus heist, the Axie Infinity, and $600 million
yes.
thefts and things.
Yes.
Like, well, what is this going to look like in future? If you were guessing now and future gazing with the increase in AI to utter those immortal letters, how does AI and that intersection of the capability of a money laundering operation, what do you think we're going to be talking about in the next couple of years?
Yeah, it's very interesting. And picking up on that case you mentioned, the Axie Infinity case, this was a hack on a video game back in 2022, during which, as you rightly say, $625 million was stolen, allegedly by the North Korean government. It's an astonishing case. It's one that I cover in the book in quite a lot of detail. I was looking for like a blockbuster chapter to end the book with, and the Axie Infinity case is it. It delivers in spades.
It doesn't get much bigger than that.
Yes. In fact, I've been circumspect in the book about this, but on podcasts and in talks, I'm a bit more ballsy, and it is, I think, the biggest theft of all time.
Yeah.
In terms of one hit on one victim valued at the time of the theft, I've struggled to find anything that's a bigger single one-off hit. Certainly in terms of speed, it took them 1:55 to steal that money.
Yeah.
That is the fastest theft on record by a long margin.
You compare that to Hatton Garden, drilling for 3 days over a bank holiday for a relatively small amount of money, yeah.
Exactly, yeah, that they then buried in graveyards and then tipped off Sky News to where they buried it. Anyway, old school crime. But what's interesting about the Axie case is it does point towards the future. The dilemma for the alleged North Korean hackers was, where do you go with $500 million of hot crypto? Like, where's got the volume and liquidity to absorb that amount of money? And is going to do that, no questions asked. This led them to a mixer called Tornado Cash, which, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, mixes incoming crypto with its pools of existing crypto and then ejects it to a fresh wallet address, which can be used for money laundering. There are some, it has to be said, legitimate privacy preserving reasons. People have told me about mixers. From the sounds of it, you look askance at those, less convinced of those. But people have used Tornado Cash, have defended it to me in ways that I found, you know, fairly reasonable. But what's interesting is speaking to the people who, I wasn't able to interview the people who created or allegedly created Tornado Cash, partly because most of them are now on trial or in prison. But one of the guys who helped fund it was fascinating. And it's worth bearing this in mind. His view of crypto in general and the blockchain in general goes way beyond currency and money and value. It goes to the heart of how we make decisions as human beings. His vision, and he's not alone in this, is that as human beings, we are failing. And if you look at our world, you look at the Middle East, you look at Ukraine, you look at cost of living crisis, inflation, you look at the Mexican border, we are failing. And we're failing because we can't coordinate our decisions properly. We are hidebound by political differences, religious differences. Their view, or at least the view of some in the crypto community, is that the crypto technology can be used to solve those things. We will be able to make decisions using this technology at scale, no matter what our color, creed, religion, race, politics, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the mixer that they set up, the technology that drove that, the sort of democratically distributed technology that that mixer used, will do that. It will allow us in the future to make decisions. And so if you interfere with this stuff and you try and shut stuff down like Tornado Cash, because you're like, oh, it's being used for money laundering, you are literally jeopardizing the future of humanity. That is how seriously they take this. Now, you can look at that and think, well, that's bollocks. You know, you're just bigging yourself up there. But this belief is so passionately held, it's hard for me to overstate how passionately held it is. And again, you may think, well, who cares what this guy thinks? These people write the future.
Yeah.
They write code that controls the future. They wrote the code of Tornado Cash and it worked very successfully and is still working today. So you may think these people are niche people we shouldn't listen to because they don't mind money laundering in favor of privacy and freedom of speech. They're happy to tolerate some money laundering. Regardless of what you think of them, they will write your future. They will write the code and write the technology that in future will change our world. So we need to listen to what they're saying and at the very least engage with it, even if you agree with it or not. So that's where I sort of see things going, is traditional entities like FinCEN, the US Treasury and so on, trying to fight this financial war, and the people who are on the technology side of it coding around that attack, using code to evade that attack. Not because they're nasty people, but because That's what coders do. See a problem, see an obstacle, code around it. That's the approach. And it's worth bearing that in mind, I think.
You know, it's a really good point. And like I say, I don't disagree. I think that the position that they're presenting is accurate. We have global money laundering that is out of control. We have a lack of prosecution and accountability for some of the worst crimes of humanity. For all the other reasons you listed off, we then have the 1% of assets recovered from criminals. I mean, it is not a good world order currently. Mm. And I completely agree. I think that it's the intersection around, in the same way, I mean, no right-minded person would say we shouldn't have an internet, but it's about how do we, you know, have industries collaborate together in a responsible way. And we have seen regulators get it horribly wrong and just try and blunt instrument things they don't understand. And as you rightly say, it just drives people to the edges. And these things will continue to exist. It's do you want them to exist in mainstream where there can be responsible attitudes towards, you know, privacy, but do it in a way that, and I think it's fundamentally because the trust is lost. Mm. And I think that's why people want to build these systems. And I do think the likes of the speed of development with things like AI as well, the results are too big. The world's most valuable company as of this morning, you know, is now in a company that is sort of building its career and NVIDIA on AI and the chips that will enable things like ChatGPT. So it's an absolute overwhelming inevitability that when you have that amount of power, it is going to become a very, very different conversation. Who would have thought 10 years ago, two US presidents would both be saying, I like crypto more than you. Both of them vie for people's sort of interest. And it is a passionate issue. It's going to be something like take two Americans and ask them about their views on gun control. And that could be a very, very partisan or bipartisan conversation. Yeah, I think we could do this for days on end. And I think that this has been a phenomenal conversation. And I would strongly recommend anyone to go and grab a copy and listen to Jeff Stoltz's Tones by doing like I've done and download it on Audible.
Thank you.
From Amazon, Rinsed, From Cartels to Crypto, How the Tech Industry Washes Money for the World's Deadliest Crooks. We'll include a link as well in the show notes. And obviously, how sort of Jeff first crossed my radar was this, the astonishing Lazarus Heist podcast and the resulting book. So Jeff, thank you very much for taking the time to join us. I believe one more trip and then you have a bit of time off as you continue the world tour. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Book tour, such as it was, is sort of coming to an end. And I'm looking forward to a nice quiet summer, maybe working on a next book. Who knows?
There you go. Well, I was going to say, I think you should be targeting asset recovery and the lack of prosecutions and money laundering in traditional finance. I think we should start to look at the old guard, because I think they're looking across at these new kids in crypto and saying, focus on them, leave us alone. That's just this podcast host personal thoughts. But Jeff, thank you very much for your time, sir. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you.
Thanks, Aidan. Appreciate it.
We appreciate Jeff taking the time to share his insights with us. If you'd like to hear more from Jeff, make sure you check out his podcasts, Artificial Intelligence, Friend or Foe, and The Dark Web. You can also grab a copy of his books, Rinsed, The Lazarus Heist, and Crime.com, and don't forget to follow him on LinkedIn. If you've enjoyed today's conversation, like and subscribe to the Cease and Desist podcast on your preferred platform, and leave a comment and any suggestions for guests you'd like to see in future episodes. Next time, Aidan will be joined by Kristen Hecht, who is uniquely positioned to provide us with compliance insights, having enjoyed a diverse career in chief compliance roles at HSBC, Meta, and Binance. They'll discuss her experiences implementing effective cross-sector compliance programs, the roles of sanctions and asset recovery amidst ever-changing regulations, and the use of emerging technologies like AI in digital asset compliance. Cease and Desist is brought to you by Asset Reality. Thank you for listening.
Our podcasts are for informational purposes only. They are not intended to provide legal, tax, financial, and/or investment advice. Listeners must consult their own advisors before making any decisions on the topics being discussed.